You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
Committee will come to order.
When Alexander Vindman warned the world about President Trump's July 2019 phone call with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, he was thinking of the U.S. Constitution and his duty as an American.
Dad, my sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected officials is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry, I'll be fine for telling the truth.
Just days after President Joe Biden announced plans to accept 100,000 Ukrainian refugees, I had a conversation with Alexander Vindman about his own immigration story, the now infamous Trump phone call, and military tactics deployed in the current crisis. You were very young when you arrived. Did that make the transition easier?
It made it very easy. We arrived in the U.S. sometime a little bit after I turned four, so I didn't have any formal schooling. Technically, my first language was Russian, but I don't know if you could really claim that as a four-year-old. I grew up in the U.S. speaking English. My Russian facility is based on the fact that my parents insisted on speaking Russian to us, which was a very excellent idea on their part that armed me to have a successful career working on Russia, Ukraine, and so forth. But it's a complex question for me to answer because I never really considered myself to be Ukrainian. Certainly growing up, I bought into the Russian propaganda about how the Ukrainian people mistreated the Jewish population through pogroms and things of that nature, which is a vast oversimplification of the history. The Russians were as complicit, if not more complicit, in those pogroms. And I tended to identify myself as a Russian Jew or a Soviet Jew or something of that nature. But as I learned more about my region, about my background, I definitely lifted the blinders and was able to understand that if there was any allegiance to that part of the world, as somebody that was raised in the U.S. but had roots in that part of the world, it was not to Russia, it was to Ukraine, a noble people that have shown their mettle recently in this war. And something that I've probably increasingly embraced, that I'm a Ukrainian-American or an American of Ukrainian origins is what I prefer to say, because the American part always goes first.
Your father had been a senior civil engineer in Ukraine, well-trained, climbing the ladder as it was in the Soviet Union in that era. Would you have, despite systemic anti-Semitism, have lived what passed for a decent Soviet life in the years to come, a cut above in housing, schooling, a vacation home? Would your family, compared to a lot of others, have done pretty well if your father hadn't decided to pull the plug and make the tough decision to start over in another part of the world?
So I think I'll take my dad's judgment on this above my own. I'd like to think that hard work would carry me through. I'd like to think that, you know, maybe my dad's hard work would kind of shelter me and offer me some opportunities. But his own conclusion is no. My father's judgment was clearly that we were not going to have the same kind of comfortable life or successful career that he had. And that's part of the reason that the U.S. established this program where refugees were welcomed from that part of the world because of anti-Semitism and the subjecting the Jewish population in the Soviet Union to anti-Semitism and to persecution, religious persecution, really.
Well, this was part of a periodic, you know, there were all during the Cold War freezes and thaws. What came to be known as the Jackson-Vanik Amendment was appended to trade law. So the Soviet Union was offered liberalized trade in return for allowing freer Jewish emigration to Israel and the United States. I'm a little older than you, so, and just a couple of neighborhoods over. So I remember when Brooklyn was filling up with newly arrived Russian speakers from several Soviet republics, eventually in the hundreds of thousands.
Brighton Beach is a long way from Hatikva. And yet here, too, there is a problem of integrating two groups of Jews from different backgrounds.
Well, after public high school in Brooklyn, you head to college and Army ROTC. When did your background, your language skills, your military vocation sort of combine and push you in the direction of becoming a specialist in the part of the world where you were born?
So I'd say the first decade, 7 years or so of my military career, were more of a conventional troop leader, infantry officer, platoon leader in Korea, executive officer, company commander. But somewhere along the way, there was always an opportunity to contribute, you know, with my language facility. At that point, there were some exchange programs. I remember when I was serving in Germany, still as an infantryman, there was an exercise, a kind of a strategic exercise called Torgau, where Russian senior generals would come in and meet with U.S. generals. This was before the Georgian War, so this is 2007, and have these exchanges. And I remember basically being voluntold. I was happy to do it, but voluntold to kind of translate and escort. And that was about the same time that I started considering where I could make the biggest contribution. There are hundreds, thousands of infantry officers, and I really enjoyed being a troop leader. It was challenging, exciting, going to Ranger school, going to airborne school, serving in combat. But I started to reflect on where I could make the biggest contribution. And I decided I could do that as a soldier statesman, as a foreign area officer, a officer that has a large diplomatic purview and portfolio. And I transitioned into that specialty.
I want to ask you something I recently asked Ambassador Michael McFaul, for a time the U.S. ambassador to Russia, who at the time of the breakup of the USSR was a young scholar living in Moscow, had a front seat to history. Did the U.S., giddy with its perceived victory in the Cold War, watching the painful reinvention of a humiliated country, understand, really understand what was happening in Russia? Did the U.S. play its hand properly? Could things have gone a different way?
Oh, absolutely. First, let me say that Mike McFaul is a dear friend and mentor. He's the one that put kind of, I remember floating the idea of maybe going to the National Security Council when I was sitting at his residence having coffee in, I think, 2014 or so. And he was like, sure, that's a great idea. I think I definitely support you. So he and I have stayed in contact over the years. He started studying this as a scholar, as you pointed out, in the 90s when I was still getting my feet under me with my academic pursuits. But in my research for my dissertation, I could say that it's a combination of failures for where we ended up with regards to Russia. Certainly, we had high hopes and expectations on working with the Russian government to transform Russia into a democratic state. We put a fairly significant amount of resources behind it. Certainly, our concepts were very, very open-minded. But we didn't put enough material resources behind it. We did not partner with the Russians the way we could have. We did not conceive of a Marshall Plan because we were in the midst of our own recessions and stuff like that. We kind of were doing a little bit of navel gazing to help transform Russia in a critical period of time, in that 1992 period, 1993 period, when we really could have, you know, proven the metal of democracy and what it can mean for prosperity. So we failed there. And then as Russia started to kind of retrench back to its comfort zone, security state, because it was an incomplete revolution, the Communist Party fell apart, but the apparatchiks, the kind of the elites, maintained power. And they were able to kind of jockey for position and ultimately gain strength, husband their strength to reassert themselves. As that process started to unfold, we were subject to some wishful thinking. Bill Clinton didn't want to burn his relationship with Boris Yeltsin. So there was a lot of kind of tiptoeing around Russia's democratic backsliding.
The challenge is to create a new Russia that benefits all responsible citizens of this country. How do you get there? I do not believe it is by reverting to the failed policies of the past.
But there was a reason to do that, though. I think there was a reason for U.S. optimism. There was a reason for Russian kind of entrenched elites to try to hang on to power in the 90s. Where it became a little bit less logical and problematic is when you get to the 2000s and the rise of Vladimir Putin, the indicators that we should have started to cast aside some of our wishful thinking about Russia and its directions. Under Vladimir Putin, Russia had started to engage in very provocative behavior. Crushed private property rights, the interests of oligarchs, waged a very devastating war against their own population in Chechnya, attempted to interfere in Ukrainian elections that resulted in the Orange Revolution, war on Georgia, all sorts of assassination attempts using chemical agents. We let these things slide, and that's probably because we were effectively manipulated by the KGB case officer, Vladimir Putin, that preyed on our hopes of having a good relationship with Russia, which were misplaced, and our fears of a devolving relationship with a nuclear power. And he was effectively able to manipulate that and stay our hand when we should have adhered to our kind of principles. And that continued on through the 2010s under President Obama and accelerated in a catastrophic way under Trump.
Ukraine had begun life as a separate entity early in the 1990s, negotiated its way out of the USSR, made deals with the Russian Federation, having to do with the divvying up of the Navy, allowed Russians the use of a Black Sea port, the transfer of its nuclear arsenal to the Russians. A big country, a major supplier of such things as grain and cooking oil, but also home to a lot of heavy industry, it had more going for it after its birth pangs than a lot of its peer, newly independent countries. Yet, as you just mentioned, it had growing pains and some difficult times early on in its nationhood.
Yep. Well, so the history between Russia and Ukraine goes back 1,000 years. It's a struggle for hegemony between what was the predecessor to Moscow and the predecessor to Ukraine. At one point, actually, Ukraine was dominant, but it was 700 years ago, the city was destroyed by the Mongol hordes. And then Russia came to ascend. At one point, there was a parity between the two countries. And there was a long struggle for Ukraine's independence under a different kind of state. Russia ended up coming out on top there. So that unfolded about 300 years ago. And Russia started to build these links with Ukraine and subordinate Ukraine for a long, long time. That project played out all the way through the 20th century with Ukraine fitfully attempting to assert its independence. They had a brief period of a couple, 3 years of independence after World War I, but the Red Army crushed and seized Ukraine and made it a communist state. And that history, what we should learn from that history is that that's a long period of time for Russia to try to kind of build networks and centralize Ukraine towards Moscow. And that's a lot for a young country to overcome. It didn't have an independent political elite that was able to conduct foreign policy. Didn't really have a military to speak of. It took the remnants of the Soviet military to build its military in 1991, 1992. And that was a struggle for the first 10 years. Really, it took 10 years for Ukraine to get its feet under it, more like 15. By the time you get to 2004, they're paving their own way. They have a different identity. They have a different understanding of who they are. They're unique, separate from Russia. And Russia feels its grasp weakening on Ukraine, Ukraine slipping through its fingers, but still has that hundreds of years mindset of Ukraine as Little Russia. That's what it was known as. You have Great Russia, which is Moscow. You have Little Russia, which is Ukraine. And you had Belarusia, which is the country of Belarus. So that is something that the Russians have not shed, their sense of exceptionalism and the dominant power in the Russian world. Ukraine shed it decades ago when it gained its independence. That was a peaceful breakup of Russia and the Soviet Union. Now the Ukrainians are fighting for their independence 30 years after they declared it.
Let's turn to the phone call that you say changed your life.
So when the president says now that he held up security assistance because he was concerned about rooting out corruption in Ukraine, that concern was not expressed in the two phone conversations that he had with President Zelensky earlier this year. Is that right?
Correct.
You had written talking points for the president in his phone meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky. He didn't use them. You had goals and objectives for the first encounter between the two leaders. They were not achieved. You sat there and you heard President Trump pressuring President Zelensky. Did you immediately understand what you heard as improper? Or did it take some reflection after hashing it out with others?
No, I mean, I understood it as improper immediately. As a matter of fact, this was the second encounter with President Zelensky. The first one was months before on April 21st, 2019, when President Trump actually did more closely execute this congratulatory phone call saying, hey, good job, President Zelensky. You won a landslide victory. You have a lot of work to do. Keep up the reforms, anti-corruption measures, but America is your friend and ally.
We had, good phone call. It was normal. We spoke about many things.
He was elected, I think, number one on the basis of stopping corruption, which unfortunately has plagued Ukraine. And if he could do that, he's doing really the whole world a big favor. I know, and I think he's going to be successful.
So that was aligned with U.S. policy. That was aligned with trying to strengthen Ukraine, trying to avoid the war that we have now by helping Ukraine reform, warning off Russia. By the time we get to the second phone call, 3 months down the road, a lot of the policy unraveled, right? Unraveled because President Trump saw an opportunity to advance his own schemes for a 2020 election, to steal an election, cast a shadow over President Biden. And I watched this unfold over the course of months. Now, I stubbornly refused to believe that the President of the United States would be directly involved. I knew that a lot of his henchmen were directly involved. Mick Mulvaney, who is his chief of staff, Rudy Giuliani, who is his personal attorney, a bunch of other people were involved, because as this scheme, this freezing of aid unfolded, I pulled this enterprise out of the shadows. I was in a senior role, not a lieutenant colonel, but a director on the National Security Council, equivalent to a 3-star. So I was able to use the power of the National Security Council to make people go on record, to offer their considered views on what we should be doing with Russia, and kind of map it out where everybody focused on national security was supportive of supporting Ukraine, foreseeing the dangers of Russia potentially escalating its war on Ukraine, and then the president, for his own personal schemes, caring less about U.S. national security, caring only about his personal interests. So the only piece that was out of place, the only piece of the puzzle that was not there, was whether the president was directly involved, even though I had heard people give me accounts that the president was the one that was ordering it, was the president on July 25th going on the record. And for me, my obligations were not loyalty to the president above loyalty to the Constitution. I knew what my responsibilities were. And when I reported this phone call, it was not to punish the president, like reporting him to the police to kind of arrest him. It was to convince him to reverse course, saying, Mr. President, this is wrong. This is criminal. If this becomes public, you'll be impeached. I have that line. I said that to my twin brother, but I also said it to the senior officials I reported the president's phone call to. The intent was really to get him to reverse course. And my belief was that was not unlikely. He had changed he had flip-flopped on U.S. policies many times because he was notorious for making bad decisions and changing his mind when somebody brought it to his attention. That was the intent. He didn't, because his interests were on tarnishing President Biden. That was the overriding concern, to prevent him from being a viable candidate going into 2020. And ultimately, it required congressional investigation and an impeachment to expose this whole matter.
Did you realize the risk that you were putting your career, and eventually even kinds of threats began to come in, that this was a momentous step that would reshape whatever was coming in the future?
I definitely knew it was momentous. I remember walking into my twin brother's office and saying, if what I'm about to tell you is ever revealed in public, the president would be impeached. So I knew the import. I knew what the president had done was a historical transgression, a historical abuse of power. My concerns for myself, frankly, at that time, there was some wishful thinking. I thought my concerns were that when I was reporting the phone call, that it would jeopardize my office, my position in the White House, that the president is notoriously vindictive. I very well maybe ending my stint there, which was not an easy thing to do because I loved my job. It was having an impact, but it was not something I was going to put in front of my obligations to the American people, to the Constitution.
One of the more remarkable aspects of the Trump impeachment is the 10,000-watt spotlight. It shone on three high-achieving Americans, experts in their respective fields, telling a devastating story about how Donald Trump's team was conducting American foreign policy, and all three were immigrants to the United States. Marie Yovanovitch, then the recently fired U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Fiona Hill, a Russia specialist on the National Security Council staff, and you, Director of European Affairs for the NSC. Amazing coincidence, but also I think it said something about America, about the kind of country this is. It's hard to think of another place in the world where the political fate of a national leader could wind up in the hands of naturalized citizens. Did you think about that right then?
I didn't, but at some point in the past, I had considered this very, very unique feature that I, as an immigrant, as a refugee from the Soviet Union, was serving in the United States Army with the highest level clearances, working in the Pentagon, facing off against the Russians at negotiating tables. And then same thing with regards to the White House and the National Security Council, and that it was completely implausible for the Russians to operate in the same way. The authoritarian regime, scared to death of its own people exercising freedoms, allowing an immigrant, you know, anywhere, even internal to Russia, not the right kind of Russian, into those kind of hallowed halls, or from an immigrant from a region. It's just not possible. It's a uniqueness about the United States and our openness and our embrace of people from around the world that kind of volunteer to be Americans. You know, I was too young to kind of do that in a thoughtful way, and then welcoming them in with all the opportunities that this country has promised to so many immigrants throughout the decades and centuries. It's a very, very unique. That's why I remain so optimistic about America and the American people, is that this is a land of opportunity in a lot of ways. Different levels of effort, of course, from different elements of society. I think it's easier for a white population than it is for a minority population, but still, based on diligence, hard work, achievements, being able to get to anywhere.
In the years since, the phone call and its aftermath has been minimized by many supporters of the president who say this wasn't really a problem because Ukraine got the weapons eventually, the hold was lifted, so no harm done. Is that true?
It's not. It is not true. I think one of the consequences of President Trump's corruption is that he made the relationship with Ukraine radioactive. It wasn't just the fact that, from a practical standpoint, that the aid was frozen and then unfrozen. It's that for the rest of the Trump administration, Ukraine was demonized by the Republican Party, or demonized by President Trump. And it was radioactive actually under the Biden administration also, because there was a lot of baggage from that Ukraine scandal and these claims of completely unsubstantiated claims of wrongdoing by President Biden. So even the Biden administration kind of held President Zelensky and Ukraine at arm's length. And that really directly set the conditions for President Putin to believe Ukraine wouldn't get the support, that the cost of conducting this offensive against Ukraine would be minimal because Ukraine was radioactive, because the Trump administration, Trump, his proxies, his henchmen, Mike Pompeo, Tucker Carlson, and his mouthpiece, Ron Johnson, the Ted Cruz's, Josh Hawley's of the world, were damning Ukraine and cheerleading Russia. And this played out all the way through the hours prior to the war.
Yesterday, reporters asked me if I thought President Putin was smart. I said, of course he's smart, to which I was greeted with, oh, that's such a terrible thing to say.
This is Joe Biden's fault. It's Joe Biden's fault for two.
So when Putin had to make a decision about whether to conduct this war, he didn't have to contend with the kind of monolithic, united front of the American government, Congress, in opposition to his aggression. He had every confidence that the U.S. was going to be divided. I remember I was advocating for this bill to levy sanctions against President Putin to signal that there would be a very heavy cost for this war. And the Republicans were impeding it. There's no way that Putin and his folks missed this. This encouraged them to believe that the U.S. was divided internally, the U.S. was weak, the U.S. was polarized, that the divide between the U.S. and our European allies within NATO was a chasm, and that there would not be a cost associated with it. And that's why I think President Trump has blood on his hands. And that's why I think the American public will hold him accountable going forward. Him and his the Republican elites that supported Putin will be held accountable going into the future elections.
I think you're saying something here that's pretty heavy, so I just want to make sure I understand it completely and you say it as simply as you can. You're saying, if I understand you correctly, that the phone call, the block, and the aftermath set in motion such American division over the future of Ukraine that this signaled to Putin that he could be green-lighted for an invasion of his neighbor. Is that fair? A fair recap of what you just told me?
That's right. I would put it in more stark terms. I think President Trump and his captured Republican Party have blood on their hands. There is a direct logic to Putin's actions and this war based on the actions of these Republicans and Donald Trump, and they are complicit in this war.
Now, Republicans on Capitol Hill are very frequently saying, and quite loudly, that if President Trump had won a second term, there would have been no invasion of Ukraine. And conversely, that it's Biden administration weakness that gave Putin the confidence he needed to make this audacious move.
Well, that's just a bunch of nonsense, smoke and mirrors, to distract from the fact that the Republican Party, in the hours before this war, was cheerleading for Putin, talking about his genius and how great a leader he was. In fact, what I could say is clear to me. If Trump had stolen the 2020 elections, if Trump had realized his scheme to tarnish Biden, he probably could have won the second election, frankly, because Biden was his most serious challenger, in a way, most acceptable to the largest swath of the American population. If he had won, either through that corruption scheme in the first scandal, or by trying to steal it in the actual election cycle and through January 6th, we would have ended up in a world where NATO would have quickly unraveled. There would not have been a coherent response to Russian aggression, and Vladimir Putin could have picked off any number of countries at his leisure. It wouldn't have been just Ukraine, frankly, with Donald Trump's blessing, because Donald Trump was talking about how genius it was for Putin to claim the eastern portion of Ukraine. Those are his words. Hours before the attack, he would have went after Moldova. There's an excellent chance he would have went after the Baltic states, because Estonia in particular is very, very close to Russia's second city, St. Petersburg. And I think we would have been in a world where Russia would have started to reconstitute, with Trump's blessing, the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire.
Hi, I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. Before we get into today's credits, I want to pay tribute to a foreign policy icon, Madeleine Korbel Albright. She passed away on March 23rd at the age of 84. I had the amazing good fortune to work for Secretary Albright during her tenure as the first woman to lead the U.S. Department of State.
Senior cabinet member and the country's top diplomat.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Madam Secretary.
I got to witness her cool and calm presence in the midst of closed-room, high-stakes negotiations, her undeniable charisma under the glare of hundreds of cameras and lights and thousands of people.
Do you ever pinch yourself?
Every morning. You know how sometimes you wake up and you think, well, I just had a nice dream. Do you think it's really true? It's a little bit like that.
Yes, Madeleine Albright was plain-spoken, proud to be an American, the U.S. her adopted homeland, and a fierce defender of democratic values in the world. But what I found most compelling about her was the warmth she had for those who worked for her. And somehow, she didn't seem to take herself too seriously, even though her responsibilities were enormous.
When she served as ambassador to the United Nations, there she stood out from the pinstripe crowd. How many times have you seen the Macarena at the Security Council?
For someone who is all of 4'9", she possessed incredible gravitas. Last May, we at World Affairs were fortunate to host Secretary Albright for a virtual forum about the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO forces from Afghanistan. When asked how she held hope amid such uncertainty, this is what she had to say.
Well, let me just say, it is my basic approach to things, being an optimist, but I'm an optimist who worries a lot. So I think we have to figure out what are the things that make us worry so that we can have the hope, because I think we are in a different era in so many different ways, and there are lessons to be learned from past times. But I think we have to approach it from a 21st century look at it in terms of new technology, in terms of new desires by people, and what can be not operating in the fear factor, but the hope factor. But it's going to require cooperation. It's not just the European responsibility, it's not just our responsibility, but it's democratic countries acting together to try to solve problems for people that have been victims of great power plays for a very long time.
Words that could be applied to the current crisis in Ukraine. Even though she's gone, Madeleine Albright's significant influence will continue to be felt for years to come because of the generation of foreign policy experts she mentored during her long career. This includes an incredible number of smart, talented, savvy women in and out of government who are leading now and will lead later. Thank you for your public service, Madeleine Albright. You will be dearly missed. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And if you missed any part of this program or want to catch up on past episodes, please subscribe to our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode was produced by Matteo Schimpf and Andrew Stelzer. Elise Manoukian is our associate producer. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.